This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9. I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutan. It's 9:35 a.m. and time for Pressing Matters. This is, of course, the show that takes you beyond the headlines of the day. And our guest today is Guy Burton, Assistant Professor of the Faculty of Social Sciences at University of Nottingham Malaysian Campus, and he teaches international relations there, which is perfect for the topic of today because we're going to be looking at the unfolding story in Brazil, because right now legislators are casting their votes on whether to approve impeachment proceedings against President Dilma Rousseff. They need a two-thirds majority of the 513 seats. So at the moment, I think they're pretty close to the finish line. 320 already voted pro-impeachment.
Guy, you've been on Night School. I don't mean to promote that show here, but and we've talked about, you know, development studies and used Latin America as an example. So you know quite a bit about Brazil in particular, and that's one of the reasons we invited you. First of all, we all say Dilma Rousseff, but and we know that's not right. Tell us, what is it? How exactly should we pronounce her name?
Yeah, it's actually Dilma Rousseff.
Dilma Rousseff.
Because nobody would recognize it if we said her name.
I don't think so. Not in Malaysia.
Okay, so this is an international story. It's a very popular story because any story of, you know, of big politicians being caught in corruption scandals. We had Jacob Zuma in South Africa recently as well. And because, you know, Malaysia has been mired in this discussion of corruption that's gripped the international media community. How exactly is the international media portraying the Brazilian story?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is there needs to be a distinction made here, because certainly there's a lot of discussion about corruption, and there is a corruption scandal going on in Brazil at the moment regarding the state oil company Petronas. A number of individuals are under investigation, including the Speaker of the House, who is currently overseeing the vote in Brazil at the moment. But what's interesting is that Dilma's situation is different. She's actually under investigation for fiddling the figures, using changing the accounting to balance the budget from a couple of years ago, as a means to facilitate, you know, her re-election. So that's what she's being.
So this is more like a trust issue, that someone in power and authority has betrayed the trust of the public, not so much enriched herself as a consequence of her actions.
Yeah. The actual term is a crime of responsibility, which is she's being investigated for. Now, you know, what's interesting is that she would argue, and the people around her argue, that presidents do this all the time, that there's Brazilian presidents have a lot of decree power. And what this is what happened in 2014 when she manipulated the figures, so to speak. But what's interesting is that I think she's lost political support now. And I think that sort of explains a lot about why she has got to the point of being investigated.
Do you think that that's an important distinction to make? I mean, when you talk about corruption, isn't that just a wide brush that you can paint everything with?
Yeah.
Petrobras or, you know, fudging numbers about the country's accounts?
Yeah. I think the government supporters see this, have called this a constitutional coup. And if you put that in the wider context of Latin America as well, we've seen a number of instances where presidents have been removed through the use of the impeachment process. Paraguay in 2012, for example, Honduras in 2009.
Now, if you look at some of the non-mainstream media, you look at, websites like counterpunch.org, kind of left of center media, they're actually framing it quite differently. And they, apart from calling it a kind of constitutional coup, they often focus on the judiciary or the judge in particular, Sergio Moro. Or they say that this is in fact a traditional elite trying to break the hold that the Workers' Party has had since 2003. I mean, how valid are those frameworks to understand what's happening?
I think what's interesting about the Workers' Party is that in many ways, Lula got elected in 2003, Dilma's predecessor, and still a significant political figure in Brazil today. What's interesting is that, in effect, the Workers' Party effectively adopted, inherited the economic model from the preceding government. One that emphasised, you know, sort of low interest rates or low interest rates and low inflation. What's interesting is they rode a boom for the last sort of 10-12 years. They started to, after sort of the recession of the early 2000s, they started to generate a surplus, which they invested into things like social redistribution, the Bolsa Familia or the family grant, which is a cash conditional transfer program that pays parents to send their children to school, which provides, you know, poorer families with sort of with fuel subsidies, with house, you know, food subsidies. So they used that, and also there was a big investment into public infrastructure as well. But what I think has been interesting is the last few years that surplus has started to die out, and I think this is we're now starting to see the repercussions for Dilma. As long as you're doing well, you have political support. But I think what's been happening over the last year or so has been Dilma seen her support eat away.
I mean, tell us something about Brazil. If I remember correctly, Brazil was sometimes described as a kind of two countries. Mm-hmm. It was a developed nation and it was an undeveloped nation. Mm-hmm. And there was this real stark divide between these two halves of Brazil. Is that an accurate description of Brazil today?
Yeah, back in the late 70s, I used to talk about Belindia, sort of Belgium and India. You know, sort of the south around sort of São Paulo, you know, the industrial part, which was reasonably wealthy compared to the north, which was very poor. Now, what's interesting is the Workers' Party, when it was first set up in 1980, much of its base was from the trade unions. It was very, very much associated with social movements. So its support was primarily around São Paulo within the industrial south. What's very interesting is that during the time of Lula's presidency, because of the Bolsa Família, a lot of the recipients of the Bolsa Família were actually in the north of the country, which is the much poorer part. And so since 2006, if you look at the electoral map, you see a switch. So much of the constituency of the Workers' Party these days are those that are actually Bolsa Família recipients, who are part of the poorer ones, who actually have benefited from the economic growth of the 2000s, because much of this was pro-poor. So I think what you do see as well is a certain sort of politics of envy in Brazil as well. There is an element of Brazilian society that has never really, you know, accepted the Workers' Party as part of the government. And so, you know, I think you sometimes see this in the discussion that's going on in things like Counterpunch.
And the makeup of the Brazilian political landscape is also quite interesting, because unlike in Malaysia, where you have, you know, one or two or three major parties, in Brazil there are many nano parties, as you've described them.
Yeah, there's effectively 25 parties in Congress at the moment. What that means is that any government has to build alliances with lots and lots of different parties in order to be able to get its program through Congress. What's interesting as well is, I think this is not the first time that Brazil has faced an impeachment vote under democracy. Democracy returned in 1985, and we actually did have an impeachment process back in 1992 against the then president Fernando Collor. The difference is that the impeachment was on the grounds of, you know, corruption, for personal enrichment. Okay. Now, Collor himself saw himself as a new type of politician, different, you know, rejecting the old guard. And he was a very much a new rights politician. But he tried to pursue a policy of privatization and liberalization. But he did so without having much of a political base in Congress. And as a result, when those corruption charges caught up with him, he found it very difficult to stay. Now, what's interesting, I think, is the same situation has been, you know, is happening here with Dilma. She's now losing political support. But the lesson that the presidents who followed Collor was that we needed to build a strong coalition, and preferably one that's not just a 50% plus one in Congress, but a substantial majority.
Now, the party Trabalho has been, or the Workers' Party has been in power since 2003. It has led government since 2003. Hasn't it been able to translate that leadership into dominance, into a kind of a hegemony in Brazilian society, political society?
I mean, there's one of the interesting things about the Workers' Party is that when they were established, and up until all the way through their opposition, between 1980 and up until 2003, they liked to portray themselves as the honest parties, the clean party, because effectively corruption does seem to sort of seep through Brazilian politics. I mean, we're talking about around 30 deputies, I believe, are under investigation at the moment because of Petrobras. But the Workers' Party historically has always been known as the clean party. That took a bit of a shock. Took a bit of a shock in 2005 when we had a previous corruption scandal called the Mensalan scandal. It literally meant big monthly payments. Effectively, at that particular point, the government was accused of using the public sector to buy the support of deputies to gain political support in Congress. When this came out, a number of people were prosecuted, including the then President Lula's chief of staff and the party treasurer. Lula himself said he had nothing to do with it, he wasn't aware of it. But I think that actually damaged the Workers' Party brand then. And from that point on, people have seen the Workers' Party as very much just another political party in Brazil.
Let's say there's a majority in the lower house. What happens next, Sky?
Well, it actually has to be a two-thirds majority in the lower house, which it requires 342 votes. And I believe we're about 20 mm-hmm. votes short of that. After this happens, effectively it goes to the Senate. In a few weeks' time, they have to vote whether or not to open a trial against her. At that point, if they vote in favour of that, and it only requires a simple majority, so 41 senators, then effectively she is suspended from her position and Michel Temer, the vice president, becomes the acting president.
For how long? I mean, how long would the vice president step in the interim?
Well, it depends how long the trial takes. I mean, the trial could take up to 3 months or so. That's roughly what's expected. But if we look at what happened, I mentioned before the break that this isn't the first time that we've had an impeachment process. Back in 1992, the then president Fernando Collor was under investigation, and he decided to resign rather than sort of go through the process of a trial. Still, what effectively happened was the Senate did sanction him and he lost his political rights for about 8 years. So he wasn't allowed to stand for election. He's now a senator. But what's interesting is I think we might certainly see different calculations start to emerge, once the impeachment vote has passed the House. I know that from earlier this week, former President Lula was talking about trying to bring together various political parties, trying to sort of rebuild support for Dilma in the lower house. But whether that's going to be sustainable after the vote is questionable.
Now, when Lula left office, and he was Dilma's mentor. He had nurtured her as the successor. But she came in with a lower majority, right? The Workers' Party did not win as strongly with Dilma coming in. You're saying now that she's essentially lost political support at a time of an economic downturn. This combination is really what's going to kill her ultimately, rather than the real stuff of the charge, which has to do with massaging figures rather than enriching herself. Mm-hmm. The question is, okay, so what is the future for the future for the social agenda that the Workers' Party represents? And Dilma, as a former activist, a Marxist, somebody who was tortured while she was an activist. What happens to that entire history?
I mean, there's a couple of things to say to that. I mean, the first thing is that the social redistribution program that happened under the Workers' Party, the Bolsa Família, the family grant, that is going to stay, regardless of whoever replaces her. That was discussed, even the opposition candidate in the 2014 election, as well as Michel Temer, the vice president, have both said, we would keep that. We're not going to change that. That's become part of the Brazilian political landscape. I think what's important is to bear in mind that Brazil, it's not just about the political society, questionable as it is. What's quite encouraging about Brazil, when I look at it, is civil society. The Workers' Party may be sort of the political, apex of, but within the sort of the social justice spectrum, we're talking about a wide range of social movements, that have been sort of pursuing social justice in Brazil for a long time. The Workers' Party, has links to those movements. For example, sort of the landless peasants movements, or those without homes. So they will continue to act regardless of who's in government. Of course, their situation will be a lot more difficult without the Workers' Party, which has been relatively sympathetic towards them. But of course, the Workers' Party is a political party, and so it has to work and it has to collaborate with others who may not necessarily sort of see their point of view. So what you've seen is, I think it was very interesting that after Lula got elected, there was a sort of sense, just like there was with Obama in 2008-09 or Tony Blair in 1997, there was this great excitement that things were going to change. But certainly, you know, those who sort of had looked and observed at what changes had happened within the Workers' Party to 2002, you know, recognized that there were going to be sort of compromises that the party was going to have to make. You know, the Workers' Party was a very radical, very, very left-wing, almost Marxist party in the 1980s and into the 1990s. But for Lula to get elected, you know, he had to make concessions, he had to make compromises. And one of those was to accept, you know, broadly the economic model that had been established in the mid-1990s.
Can we step away from the Brazilian case in particular? Just look at the larger field of Latin America. We see the problems that Venezuela is in. There's a political crisis that's been protracted. We see, you know, and but because the last decade has been marked by these extraordinary wins by non-traditional parties, left-wing or center-left parties, what has been borne out by the experience? The last 20 years, has it proved that through politics you can actually institute social change of a significant sort?
And there's a couple of things that you know, have talked that point to the extraordinary rise of the centre-left, what they call the pink tide, during the 2000s. I think what you've got to bear in mind is that, you know, at the end of the 1990s, there was a sense of enormous exhaustion and frustration with the neoliberal agenda, with the structural adjustment programs that had been required of many of the Latin American governments as a result of sort of IMF loans and conditionality during the 1990s. So there was a sense that the political class is not necessarily listening to us. You know, we're suffering and we're struggling. Mm-hmm. So that sort of contributed to a willingness to vote for, you know, the other side, for the left. Now, what's interesting is that much of that left as well had shifted as well. It had shifted away from sort of the pre-1989, pre-Cold, you know, the Cold War left, very much identified with the sort of with Cuba, to a much more social democratic model. And certainly in 2006, Jorge Castañeda, the then a former Mexican foreign minister and also a scholar, wrote in Foreign Affairs about these two lefts that were emerging in Latin America. One which was a very social democratic left associated with, you know, Lula and his predecessors in Brazil, and a more sort of radical populist left like Evo Morales in Bolivia and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. What I think is also interesting about these other lefts is that the last decade was a time of economic boom, of commodity boom, and especially sort of rising oil and gas prices, which benefited Venezuela and Bolivia respectively.
Right.
Now, of course, we're starting to see a downturn.
That's changed.
And that's, of course, exactly now starting to have a knock-on effect on the economies of those countries and also the political support there as well.
So very quickly, Guy, I'd like to get a sense of where you think Brazil is heading. So if we were to factor into all the votes and moving into Senate and the like, where do you see Brazil heading in terms of its political leanings? Will this change anything in its political landscape?
I mean, you've got a situation where, as I think I pointed out, that there's at least 30 deputies who are currently under investigation for, you know, the Petrobras scandal and corruption as well. So there is a sense in Brazil of, you know, of the political class sort of being endemically corrupt. This has been consistent. I mean, the one encouraging thing to see out of all of this is that, you know, the fourth estate is very strong in Brazil. I mean, there's a lot of exposure about this. Granted, on the left, it's seen as very sort of anti-workers' party. But we also have a very sort of strong judicial system as well. We've seen over the last sort of 10 years or so, you know, a strengthening of the federal prosecutor's office, you know, much more activist role by judges, which is actually what prompted this whole investigation into the Petrobras scandal in the first instance.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, so, you know, and talking about judges, there's a bit of a scandal around the judge himself, Sergio Moro, who leaked, you know, tapes. Is there a sense, I mean, I'm reading the left-wing press here, that the judiciary is, in fact, biased towards the elite? There's a class bias in the way the judges have operated.
Yeah. There is. Certainly, there's a very sort of a very robust and activist judiciary, and I think maybe that could be potentially a reaction to sort of the past, especially sort of Brazil's, you know, military period. There's a sense that we need to have some degree of sort of independent actors operating. I think what becomes challenging is when we talk about this idea of there being, you know, sort of this groundswell of opposition to the Workers' Party. It seems it seems somewhat broad and amorphous. I mean, we're talking when that you're sort of suggesting that, you know, judges and the business elite and the media, they've all got an agenda.
Conspired somehow.
And certainly that's sort of the view that's sort of presented on the left. Now, I'm not sure that, I mean, certainly it would seem to me that there's possibly lots of different agendas all coming together at the same time. But whether there's sort of a conspiracy, which is what the left seems to be alleging, I question.
Is there a successor for Dilma Rousseff in the Workers' Party if she is impeached, if she does stand down, if her leadership of the party becomes untenable? And who might that be?
Well, actually, the potential successor to Dilma would actually be her predecessor, Lula. Although he's currently under investigation himself as well for potential money, for alleged money laundering as well, he is actually the only candidate of any potential stature in the Workers' Party. And some have argued, suggested that Dilma was always a stopgap, that a little bit like, a little bit like Putin and Medvedev, Putin coming back after Medvedev.
Like a placeholder.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. The same thing in Brazil, that Dilma would be followed by Lula again.
What about Temer? Does he have a huge following? Is he not a viable candidate?
Political parties are offering their support to him, but it's very challenging to see whether or not he's going to be able to do this long term. Certainly, any president who emerges out of an impeachment process who hasn't faced the electorate is going to face the question of legitimacy.
Sure. Well, it's now 9:58, and you've just heard Guy Burton, our guest today, the assistant professor with the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Nottingham Malaysia campus, with his experiences and knowledge on Brazil. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutan, and you've been listening to Pressing Matters on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.